Let's open our Bibles back to Genesis chapter 6 and continue with our study of the flood, which changed everything. The book of Genesis is a book of beginnings, and the flood is the beginning of a brand new world. And so we need to really understand how the old world was messed up and done away with so that God could start fresh with a whole new batch of people and animals. And here's that story. There are stories about a universal flood all through the traditional writings and oral traditions of the people groups around the world. But this one is the authorized version. This one is the one given by God by inspiration to Moses to be written down for our benefit. And so let's see what he tells us. Genesis chapter 6, verse 13 says, God said to Noah, I have determined to make an end of all flesh, for the earth is filled with violence through them. Behold, I will destroy them with the earth. So mankind, through his own free will choice, has already been moving away from God. And as I said, in the last few generations before the flood, that deterioration morally picks up speed because a group of fallen angels, not all of them, Satan doesn't seem to be involved in this one, but a group of fallen angels decide to start playing around with the human genome. There's even some indication that they started monkeying around with the animal genomes as well. This leads to mankind becoming so sinful, so rebellious, that he can't even come up with new ways fast enough to flip God off, to stick his thumb in God's eye, to basically say to God, you can't tell me what to do. And so God's had enough. He sighs that exasperated sigh that we talked about and says, I'm going to start fresh. And he sees Noah and his family as being the representation of humanity that is still good enough to start over with. And so he tells him what the plan is and then gives him a job, because Noah needs to be invested in this. He needs to take his part in this role of being saved out of this sinful world into the world to come. Now, he's not saving himself by coming up with this plan on his own. He is actually responding to God's directives. And so this is very interesting as a parallel to our own circumstances. Jesus has fixed the sin issue, but we are expected to participate in that solution. Okay, back to the text. Here's what he tells him, verse 14. Make yourself an ark of gopher wood. The word ark just means box, and I think it's possible that's exactly what it looked like. It was a great, big, long, wooden box. Now, I know Answers in Genesis, which I have recommended to you recently, has their ark encounter that has rounded ends on it. And they give you all the reasons why they do that from extra-biblical history and traditions. But I am aware that there is an eyewitness account, supposed, of a young Armenian boy in the early 1900s who said that during a period of unusual visibility on the top of Mount Ararat, he was taken there by his uncle and saw the Holy Ark. And what he described and what has been sketched out by people familiar with his story was a box shape. And that had been, for quite some time, what circulated around in the creationist teachings and writings about the ark. I have to confess, I still lean toward that boxiness. And I appreciate everything that Answers in Genesis does, but I wonder whether or not they might be trying to put too much extra stuff into the retelling of the story for their own purposes. I'll just leave it at that, okay? So I think you should still go and see the Ark Encounter, and I think you should listen to everything they say about the building of the Ark, just to understand that it might still be that box shape that is seen in materials previous to the building of the Ark Encounter. So the gopher wood that's mentioned here, the gopher represents the pronunciation of the Hebrew word, and nobody knows what this word means. The Hebrew speakers of 280 BC, who helped write the Greek translation of the Old Testament, they translated this as squared off wood, meaning milled lumber, lumber that had angles and flat sides. So that's the closest I can tell you that this word might mean. But even that, we're not sure. Next thing that he's told is make rooms or little nests in the ark. So this box is going to be subdivided. And then cover it inside and out with pitch. Bitumen is a waterproofing substance. Even the tightest seams might still leak, especially under pressure, under all of the turmoil that's going to be part of the flood. So everything gets sealed with sealant inside and out. So it'll be very waterproof. This is how you're to make it, the length of the ark, 300 cubits. Now we start getting to the dimensions. And this is where I have to explain to you that there are two cubits of history. The traditional one, which most of the commentaries use and which footnotes will often translate the cubits into feet by this standard, is 18 inches. A cubit represents the span from an elbow to the tip of the middle finger on an average adult male. And that has been for a long time understood as 18 inches. Now, it just so happens my cubit is exactly 18 inches. And I'm 5'8" up to about 5'9", depending on when I've been to the chiropractor. And so I seem to be roughly the average height of an ancient male. Now, when I say ancient, I'm talking about Bible writing time period from, you know, the 1,000 or so, 1,500 up to the time of the New Testament. So somewhere in that range, the average adult male must have been right around 5'8", 5'9". And 26% of your height tends to be the length of your cubit. And so that's 18 inches. If we take that ratio and look at the much older Egyptian royal cubit that we know exists, much older than the biblical cubit I'm talking about right now, that cubit is 20.7 inches. It's the cubit that was used in the measurement of the pyramids on Giza. That seems to represent a person about 6'8", 6'9". So almost 1 foot taller than myself and the average adult male of a biblical time period. So people must have been taller closer to the flood, and that might match what we know about the deterioration of the human genome continuing even after the flood. Because the flood is so far back in history, I think it is much more appropriate to use the ancient cubit. And so the figures I give you will be longer than the ones you might see as footnotes in your Bible, or which you might see in commentaries or hear in any type of preaching and teaching about the flood. So that's the reason why my measurements are bigger, okay? So its length is 300 cubits, and so that'd be about 517.5 feet. Its breadth, 50 cubits, that would be 86.25 feet. And its height, 30 cubits, and so that'd be 51.75 feet. So this is one big box. This is a big boat. In fact, no other boat approached this size until the modern period. We're talking about in the later 17, early 1800s, I think. Everything was smaller than this. It's monstrous. When we take the numbers that I just ran across in front of you, that's about 2.3 million cubic feet of storage space. So there's a lot of room in this thing, and it's all well divided up. Verse number 16, make a roof for the ark and finish it to a cubit above. Now, the language here is a little bit clumsy in the English because we're not exactly sure, I think, sometimes how to interpret the language of the Hebrew here. It's got something to do with when you're finishing off the top, there's apparently some sort of light access or ventilation access that's a cubit from the top of this finished ark. And that all makes good sense to us as well. If you've got a box like this, you need ventilation. You can't just seal it up and have everybody, all the humans and all of the animals in it for a year and expect them to survive. There has to be some sort of fresh air coming in. And so that seems to be what that's describing here. Others think that there might be a description of providing light holes so that illumination from the day of each day that they're on board will come through these openings up at the top center. And many of the old designs that you see of the ark has like a raised place all along the center top with places for light and air to get in where it would not provide a way for the water to get in. And I'm all good with that. I will tell you that there is an ancient Jewish tradition that the light in the ark was provided through great big pearls that glowed. And I am intrigued by that. We don't know what the technology was like in the planet previous to the flood. By my calculations, there were 2,200 years worth of human history before the flood came along. And it may be that they'd come up with an awful lot of interesting technology that got lost in the flood. And so they may have had some sort of illumination technique, maybe electrical, might be chemical, that Noah made use of during his time on the flood. So just throwing that out there for you to kind of chew on. Then, verse 16 says, set the door of the ark in its side. So we have to have an access port, some way to get on and off later. So that's going to be the door. Where it hooks up is probably much higher up on it, because a door is going to have more possibilities for water to get in You're going to have to come up with a sealing mechanism to keep the water out. But it would be best to keep that well above what will be the water line later. So my guess is that since we're about to read there's three decks on this boat, on this barge, on this great big box, that the access door was to the top deck. And that there was then internal access to the lower two decks. Let's go ahead and read about that. Verse 16 says, make it with lower, second, and third decks. Now, since we know that it's almost 52 feet high, we can divide that number by three and see immediately that each deck has about 17 feet of height designated. Now, some of that height is going to be in decking. So you can't get all of that. So possibly each deck is 16, 15 feet tall. That's a lot of space. And it's more than likely that each of the decks then has multiple levels within it of these different rooms or nests or storage places where the animals are going to be stored during the year that they're on the ark. Verse number 17. For behold, I will bring a flood of waters upon the earth to destroy all flesh in which is the breath of life under heaven. Everything that is on the earth shall die. Now, that means all land animals are going to be drowned out. And so they're the ones that are going to be brought onto the ark. The water-going animals are not going to be brought into the ark. There's going to be plenty of water for them to be in. They can survive. But all the land animals, right down to the little bitty insects and such, some sort of representative sample of them are going to be brought on board the ark. Now, immediately, a lot of people object to this, saying, there is no way in the world you could get all of the different species on board the ark. Now, the problem is, the moment you say that, you show that you have a different take on the animals that went aboard the ark than what creationists do. Because creationists understand you don't need every, quote, species, meaning all these different subdivisions of animals. You just need the representative kind that all those different animals come from. Meaning, you don't need St. Bernards and Chihuahuas and Pekingese. All you need is the dog kind. You don't need lions and tigers and domestic cats and all of that necessarily. All you need is the cat kind. And so when you start looking at the interbreeding capability of all of the animals that exist today, and you say, okay, all we need is the core pair that would provide all of those various, or all those variants that come out of that breeding kind, all we need is the centipede, the central part of the gene pool for that group. Immediately, the numbers of animals is radically reduced. So people who know how to do all of this stuff, and you can go to the various creationist websites that I told you about to see some of their numbers, they say there's no problem. You'd have zero difficulty fitting all of the breeding kinds of animals onto this massive boat. Verse number 18. But I will establish my covenant with you, and you shall come into the ark, you and your sons, your wife, your sons' wives with you. Now, the wives here are the ones that they're engaged to. The indication is that during the pre-flood period, marriage was delayed until your second century of life. And so these guys are all under the age of 100, would it seem, except for Shem. He seems to be 102 when the flood starts, I believe. So these guys bring their fiancés with them into the ark. And that's the group that all humanity is going to come from. These eight people, specifically the three couples, are focused on as the source of all post-flood humanity. Verse number 19, of all or every living thing of all flesh, you shall bring two of every sort into the ark, keep them alive with you. They shall be male and female. Of the birds according to their kinds, birds here is the word for flyers, so that would include bats and stuff like that. And of the animals according to their kind, every creeping thing of the ground according to its kind, two of every sort shall come in to you to keep them alive. And you shall take with you every sort of food that is eaten and stored up, and it shall serve as food for you and for them. Now this brings us now to another thing that a lot of people want to gripe at and say, this is all myth, it couldn't possibly be done. And they point to about the food. How are you going to bring all that food on board for an entire year? And how are you going to keep the carnivores from eating the herbivores? Well, first of all, everybody in these animal groups were designed to be herbivores. So the only type of food they're bringing on board is vegetation. The design of God at the very beginning of time, was that even lions ate grass and grain and stuff like that. So that's not a problem of your passengers eating one another. The other thing is, it is likely that only the younger types of animals were taken on board. You don't have to have an adult in order to start fresh in the new world. In fact, it might be much easier to take the small young animals on board. And they are much easier to manage and deal with, and they eat less over this long period of time. So that's likely what's going on. We've also got the possibility that they didn't stay awake the full period of the flood. We know that there are still plenty of animals that practice a type of sleep, hibernation, if you will, during times when the weather does not provide the opportunity to eat on a regular basis. And so you have things like the bears that can eat a whole bunch and then lay down, and they pretty much nap for several months. And some of them are even pregnant whenever they start taking their winter nap. This is an energy conservation technique. It might actually have its origin in the flood, that God caused these animals to, once they were on board and got themselves all situated, they were able to just hibernate, rest, go into a sort of God-given suspended animation. And I really like that as a viable mechanism as to how God provided for Noah and Mrs. Noah, and Shem, Ham, Japheth, and their wives to get through this ordeal with the least amount of trouble. So they weren't having to feed animals every single day, and they weren't having to scoop out the manure every single day, because that's also another question that people ask. And animals that are hibernating do not produce the waste that animals that are up and active do. Verse number 22. So Noah did this. He did all that God commanded him. Now, when he did that, he showed his faith in God. The book of Hebrews makes a big deal out of this. And so does Peter when he talks about Noah. Noah had never seen rain before. That's pretty clear. And yet when God tells him, I'm going to use this mechanism to wipe out the entire world and start fresh with you and all these different animals, Noah acted in faith. He did what God told him to do. And by doing that, he saved himself and his family. And so we need to have the same attitude, folks. When God tells us that we are sinners in need of a Savior, and Jesus is that Savior that we need to put our faith in, we need to act on that truth. Have a great weekend.